I hope I am properly wired so you can hear what I'm saying. This is the first time, and yesterday, that I had an opportunity to engage in some kind of intellectual discourse or connection with the French people. I have been to France many times earlier, but always only in the capacity of the tourist. This is something different. So I am very pleased to have this opportunity to, especially in the question and answer period, to learn something about your interests and opinions on this interesting subject. What I will be doing, first I will say something about this very basic question as to what is and what is not anti-Americanism. Then I will suggest some sort of a typology and an explanation of its sources, where it comes from. And then I will move on to the matter of why it has intensified in the last decade or last 2 decades. Actually, there have been several periods of intensification, one after 1989 and another one after 2001. And finally, time permitting, I will say something about anti-Americanism and intellectuals. As to the typologies or types, one very basic distinction is between domestic and foreign. By domestic, I mean the anti-Americanism of Americans. And I think in general, there is much more awareness of anti-Americanism as something directed at the United States from abroad than something which is also generated within the United States. Then another typology might be left-wing and right-wing anti-Americanism. Or you could have a further geographical subdivision such as European, Third World, Latin American, Asian, or a category of its own, Islamic, which of course is especially important at the present time. But maybe I will start with the, and then of course I move on to the possible explanations. But let me start with this question of what is and what isn't anti-Americanism. Because it is often difficult to separate anti-Americanism from the well-founded critiques of the United States or well-founded grievances against the United States. Especially because the grievances often give rise to critiques. In other words, justified critiques of the United States often combine with or culminate in an undifferentiated hostility or in sweeping rejection. In other words, even the most embittered anti-American may be correct about certain specifics of the indictment, without justifying the overall conclusions. In my first book on the subject, I offered this kind of definition of anti-Americanism. An adversarial view of American society and culture. It usually entails the exaggeration of the flaws and failings of American policies, institutions, and values. It also leads to or amounts to an unrealistic and inflated view of the responsibility of the American social system for various problems, both within the United States and globally. In other words, anti-Americanism is more than a critical disposition. It usually amounts to a predisposition, a free-floating hostility or aversion that feeds on many sources, besides the discernible shortcomings of the United States. So that's a definition of sorts. But maybe the best way to understand anti-Americanism to offer you some specimen, some examples of, you know, when somebody says something and I say, well, this is it, this really has to be classified as anti-Americanism. But just to go back for 1 second to what I said earlier, before I offer you these examples, I think that understanding anti-Americanism may be achieved by balancing two apparently incompatible perspectives or propositions. The first one is that anti-Americanism is a direct and rational response to the misdeeds of the United States abroad and its shortcomings at home and inequities at home. In other words, that is created what the United States does, or possibly even the behavior of individual Americans. In other words, that it's a readily understandable response. Now, the other approach to which I suggested in that definition earlier, that Americanism, anti-Americanism is a often groundless and to varying degrees irrational predisposition. Somewhat similar to racism, sexism, anti-Semitism, an expression of deeply rooted scapegoating impulses, a disposition more closely related to the problems, frustrations, and grievances of those entertaining it and articulating it, whether they are individuals or groups, than to the real attributes or policies of America or United States. So these are two conflicting approaches, and it's sometimes not easy to reconcile them. As I said, mainly because of the fact that you can hold justifiable critiques of the United States without being anti-American, but then anti-Americanism, this irrational, unqualified rejection also incorporates valid criticisms. So perhaps when I give you some examples of anti-Americanism that helps to nail down the phenomenon. Another interesting thing that should be mentioned, that anti-Americanism at the present time, and well, it has been with us for a long time, but especially in recent times, say in this century certainly, or since World War II, has been accompanied by this enormous pent-up desire of millions and tens of millions of people who want to go to the United States globally. So this is an interesting phenomenon. From all corners of the world, people are trying to get into the United States, and many of them, of course, still do, legally or illegally. Now, you might say, using the old Marxist concept, that all these people trying to get into the United States suffer of false consciousness, that they are deluded. They don't know what's good for them. They don't know their true interests. Now, these are mostly these multitudes, you know, you may think about the Mexicans and all kinds of people from impoverished countries. You could possibly argue that they really don't understand what kind of a society America is. They just want to go there because there is work and they get better paid than at home. But actually, intellectuals are also interested in at least visiting the United States or studying in the United States, even Mexican intellectuals. And intellectuals abroad, including those who are highly critical of the United States, get a very friendly reception in the United States in academic environment, just as critics of the United States, you know, like Chomsky or Michael Moore, when they come to Europe, they get a very friendly reception here. So the domestic and the foreign critiques are very much interdependent. They validate one another. They offer proof that the critic is correct, because the Americans themselves admit these serious flaws and defects of America, or the American looks abroad and says that his criticisms are validated and supported by people abroad based on their own experiences. But let's look at some of these comments about the United States, which I think help to illustrate some of the essential attributes of these criticisms and the non-rational aspects of it. Why don't I start with your famous countryman, the late Jean Baudrillard, who traveled widely in the United States. He actually has a book of his travels where I got some of these quotes from. And then he also made some notable comments after 9/11. But during his travels, this comes from his travel book, he said, here are some comments he made about the United States. America is a world completely rotten with wealth, power, senility, indifference, puritanism, mental hygiene, poverty, waste, technological futility, and aimless violence. The only country where quantity can be extolled without compunction. Then, upon visiting Death Valley, now you know Death Valley is the hottest place in the United States, maybe one of the hottest places in the world, he observed, here everything human is artificial. Furnace Creek in Death Valley is a synthetic air-conditioned oasis. You see, there was some concern on his part that having air conditioning in Death Valley is part of this dehumanization associated with technology. He also complained about the American freeways. An extraordinary spectacle of the thousands of cars moving, coming from nowhere, going nowhere, ceaselessly unrolling without objectives. Well, you wonder if the French superhighways or autoroutes are that different, and would you be also puzzled by the objectives or itineraries of French drivers? But the point is that I think a very interesting core of his objections to America was this idea, which he shares with other observers and commentators and critics, that there is some, and this kind of criticism goes back to the 18th century, well before people were upset about the ravages of technology. This idea that America is somehow unnatural and inauthentic. And in the 18th century, some of the early travelers and observers even thought that the flora and the fauna, you know, the plants and animals in America, in North America, were somehow strange and inferior to what you found in Europe. This is a more puzzling observation. I think some of these points which Baudrillard made really amount to, and I was going to come to that later when I tried to explain the phenomenon, I think some of these comments really amount to the rejection or criticism of modernity, which of course the United States represents and spreads. So let's see some other comments which further illuminate the nature of this phenomenon. Here is Noam Chomsky, who is probably the most outstanding representative of the domestic critics of the United States, and whose rejection is the most visceral. And he many times said that the United States is really worse than Nazi Germany. For example, he proposed not only that the United States is the foremost terrorist state, but he said that when the United States bombed the pharmaceutical factory in Sudan, which was an error, obviously, this was a far more hideous act than the attacks of 9/11. And that 9/11 provided an excuse for the United States to destroy the hunger-stricken country of Afghanistan. Edward Said, acclaimed literary scholar, declared in an Egyptian, though not an American, publication that the United States was a genocidal power, quote, with a history of reducing whole peoples, countries, even continents to ruin by nothing short of Holocaust. Eric Foner, very well known in the United States, professor of history at Columbia, couldn't decide, quote, which is more frightening, the horror that engulfed New York City or the apocalyptic terror emanating daily from the White House. Now, this again is worth pausing because one aspect in, or one attribute of the what might be called the methodology of anti-Americanism is this kind of moral equivalence that the United States is compared to something which is self-evidently worse, you know, like the Nazis. Or in the old days during the Cold War, the United States was regularly compared to the Soviet Union, again, moral equivalence. Or also the United States was more recently compared to the terrorists, the Islamic terrorists. I have a quote to some effect. Oliver Stone, the famous filmmaker, called 9/11 a revolt and equated the Palestinians dancing on the streets when they learned about 9/11, equated it with the public rejoicing occasioned by the French and Russian Revolution. Lesser known here, I am sure, Kate Apollett, an editor of The Nation, told her daughter who wanted to fly an American flag out of their window after 9/11 that, quote, "The flag stands for jingoism and vengeance and war." Susan Sontag, the late Susan Sontag, was more enraged by what she called our robotic president and the public figures supporting him by the terrorists whose actions she considered, quote, "a consequence of specific American alliances and actions." This actually was a very widespread sentiment after 9/11 among some American intellectuals on the left that the United States was basically responsible for these attacks because of the so-called root causes, that it brought it upon itself by its policies. Norman Mailer, who also died recently, had an interesting quote about the matter. That is about after 9/11. He said, "Everything wrong with America led to the point where the country built that Tower of Babel, you know, the towers which were destroyed, which consequently had to be destroyed." Now, Norman Mailer also had an interesting theory of the Iraq War. And I am not objecting to critics of the Iraq War. Far from it. I share the critics of the Iraq War. But he just had a very interesting criticism, which I reread for you because it's sort of entertaining. He said that the Iraq War was a reflection of the compulsive pursuit of manhood designed to alleviate the ongoing malaise of the white American male. That is to say, we went to war because we very much needed a successful war as a species of psychic rejuvenation. Now, this is a very interesting attribution coming from a person whose personal life and work has been preoccupied with the attainment of true masculinity, you might say. Here we have a nice case of projection. Mailer also said somewhere else, this is actually something both Mailer and Baudrillard said, that I mean, maybe I will find the quote in a moment, that the World Trade Center had to be destroyed because it was also an aesthetic monstrosity. And working inside was a horrible deprivation. Not only that it was symbolic of capitalism, which of course has been said many times, much more commonly. A professor of philosophy, not so well known probably in France, Robert Paul Churchill, his name at George Washington University, said, "What the terrorists despised and sought to defeat was our arrogance, our gluttonous way of life, our miserliness toward the poor and starving, the exportation of a soulless pop culture, and a domineering attitude that insists on having our way no matter what cost it costs to others." So Harold Pinter, now he, a great playwright who also became obsessed in this kind of negative way with the United States. I don't know when exactly it began. But he clearly feels that this is a exceptionally evil and repugnant society. He said, for example, I think he said this when he made his Nobel Prize acceptance speech. He said, "The United States has exercised a sustained, systematic, remorseless, and cynical manipulation of the world. while masquerading as a force for universal good, arrogant, indifferent. This is not the most dangerous power in the world. This is the most dangerous power the world has ever known. The rogue state, the United States, has confirmed that it is a fully fledged, award-winning, gold-plated monster. It has effectively declared war on the world. It knows only one language, bomb and death. And then we have Carlos Fuentes, the well-known Mexican writer, who compares the United States to past totalitarian systems and Nazism in particular, writing that Hitler and Stalin made the mistake of demanding personal homage superior to those deserved by their own nations. Washington's circle of power is infinitely more capable. It shields itself within the nation and gives it a total and exclusive ecumenical value. Just as Hitler advanced in the name of the German folk and Stalin in the name of proletariat, Bush claims to act in the name of the people of the United States. Such a declaration locates us once more before the great lie that Hitler so astutely evoked. And then he goes on to say, I don't compare Bush with Hitler and Stalin to equate them, but to distinguish them. The Nazi and Soviet dictators faced other powerful states, whereas the United States president governs the country with no external counterforce. You see, this is very closely related to the perception of the United States as a superpower. I have another little interesting tidbit here of these perceptions and comparisons of the United States to other historically much more destructive American politicians or leaders compared with other historically far more destructive figures. When I wrote my book on anti-Americanism in the early 90s, well, that's when it was published, the book includes the results of a survey. I conducted a little survey of my own, although in general I am not much of a quantitative sociologist, but I thought here we have some kind of a little survey, which included Canadian and Mexican academics in the social sciences and humanities who were sent questionnaires by mail. And, you know, I asked them to compare American and, no, I guess the question I am talking about now, I asked the question and then I don't remember now if it was open-ended or not, or I had a list of names or politicians, but basically asked them questions that, who do you think was the most destructive or ruthless political leader in the 20th century? Now I am quote, I remember this is the Canadian result, not the Mexican, because you would be less surprised if Mexicans are anti-American for good historical reasons. But the Mexican, the majority of the Mexican respondents, hundreds of people were involved in the sample, not a huge sample. But the vast majority of them thought that Reagan was much more dangerous and destructive and evil than Stalin. So, you know, well, what can one make of that? And Günter Grass, he wrote that the United States was disqualified. This was in the 1980s, well before Iraq. That the United States was disqualified from making moral judgments about anything. And then you have, I don't have a quote, but there is the famous French book which came out after 9/11, the author of which proposed that the Pentagon was struck not by an airplane, but by a truck bomb planted by rogue US military officers, which I understand was a bestseller in France. And also proposed that Bin Laden was the CIA stooge. And 9/11 was carried out by agents of the military-industrial complex to justify dramatic increases in defense spending and the invasion of Afghanistan. So, you know, I could offer many more quotes, but that may be sufficient to illustrate the phenomenon. You could also say that one characteristic of this attitude is, as most highly emotional political judgments, that people cease to make distinctions. This kind of moral equivalence. Another example that comes to my mind from another context, this was not about anti-Americanism, but just an illustration of this decline of the capacity for moral judgment or differentiation. And this is something I quoted in a book of mine. I don't know if it was mentioned in the introductory remarks or not. I have a book called Political Pilgrims, and the subtitle is Travels of Western Intellectuals to the Soviet Union, China, and Cuba, all the way from the 1920s up to the present. Of course, there are discussions of the social background, which after all, the social background stimulated and the domestic social criticism stimulated these, what I call pilgrimages and the favorable disposition towards first the Soviet Union, then Mao's China, Castro's Cuba, etc. And one of these sweeping parallels or comparisons that was made by a number of people at the time, what they called the Hollywood purges and the Soviet purges. Well, you know what Soviet purges were in the 1930s, which had the show trials, millions of people sent to the Gulag, and hundreds of thousands shot. And the Hollywood purges were the result of McCarthyism, when people who were or were suspected of supporting the Communist Party of the United States lost their jobs. So Hollywood purges and the Soviet purges. So this loss of reason judgment is characteristic of anti-Americanism. Now, hopefully I gave you some illustrations of the attitudes involved here. And again, it's important to remember that the problem is how to separate what is a justified criticism from the unjustified criticism. It might be of some interest to you if I read to you something I wrote when I first arrived to the United States. And that was a long time ago. But when I first arrived to the United States and started graduate school, I was very anti-American. Or maybe I wasn't anti-American as such, but I had many criticisms of the United States. And here is one thing I complained about. You know, this what I'm reading to you was written 40 years ago. But actually, I still think it has some validity, the point I made at the time. I think this is still a valid criticism of American culture and society. And this is what I wrote 40 years ago. The spectacle of a moral, ethical, aesthetic free-for-all, the rapid changes in moral fashions, the determined and self-conscious quest for self-expression or self-realization, the unqualified, quote, openness to change, a self-evident virtue within American culture that inspires incomprehension or apprehension in those who are not the products of this society, and is frequently associated with suggestibility, instability, inability to discriminate, and with moral confusion, all of which are indeed abundant in American society. These were the things which bothered me at the time. This was before the rise of postmodernism and moral relativism, but apparently I already sensed there was something along these lines in the United States, in American culture. And of course, another thing associated with this comment I made, this complaint I made, that what I also found very strange in America, and actually I think this is what I'm about to mention, is also one of the sources of the criticism directed at American society, is the so-called problems, or are the so-called problems of identity. This was something else very puzzling to me initially when I first came to America. You know, what's this business of people don't know who they are? Why is that such a mystery? You know, we can say we are, can of course have these basic gender or sex categories. We know our age, we know our social background, religious, social class membership, whatever, and that's what we are. But of course, the identity problems arise from the fact of an inflated notion of individuality or individualism. And I think that brings us to the problems of modernity, which in my opinion is a major source of anti-Americanism, by no means the only one. I think it is in modern societies that people develop these identity problems, and they don't know who they are, partly because of this development of what some people call radical individualism, which means that people believe that they have this they have unique needs and unique potentials for growth. This is also part of the Romantic American view. Perhaps it goes back to Rousseau and others, you know, the underlying human nature, or a French Enlightenment. But in America, it has been sort of popularized, that everybody has these great, unique personal potentials which can and should be realized. Well, you can see how this can lead also to problems of identity. But some more general propositions about modernity, which are closely associated with the United States. You know, modernity, Americanization, Westernization, they hang together, almost synonymous. And of course, on the one hand, everybody wants the obvious benefits of modernity, technological progress, higher standard of living, high levels of physical and social mobility, personal and group freedoms, opportunities. Certainly, it's not entirely mythical that the United States is or was a land of opportunity. Not entirely mythical. But these are some of the obvious benefits of modernity: personal freedom, mobility, higher standard of living. I wouldn't say materialism. Incidentally, this is another interesting issue, that Americans are often criticized for being materialistic. And when I hear this criticism, or when I read that criticism, I always ask the question, compared to whom? You know, show me groups of people who are less materialistic other than Buddhist monks. Where are they? In China, India, France, Greece, Italy? Where are these non-materialistic masses of people? I think what happens in America, that people, because the standards of living are high, more people can enjoy the pleasures of materialism. So it's more obvious. You go to a shopping mall, a shopping center, and you see these masses of people engaged in what might be called recreational shopping. That is to say, they go there not because of some specific need, but they just walk around and see what they may want to buy, this kind of thing. So I don't think Americans are particularly materialistic. But there is something else along these lines which is sometimes confused with materialism. It is true that Americans have a tendency to measure themselves or one another in terms of their income. But that's something different, you know. And this is associated with these astronomical incomes of the CEOs or Hollywood celebrities or football players. And these are incomes which you cannot spend. There is so much money, you know. How can you spend hundreds of millions of dollars a year? So it's a kind of symbolic yardstick, a measure of accomplishment. And that's why people pursue it, in my opinion. That's something different from materialism. To be sure, this is not necessarily a good way to measure personal worth, but it's not materialism. So, but there are some other more obvious problems of modernity the United States or American culture is associated with. Foremost, the loss or decline of taken-for-granted beliefs. That is clearly something that used to hold traditional societies together, taken-for-granted beliefs, and make individual lives meaningful. And of course, when there is this kind of decline of taken-for-granted beliefs and of social roles, then you have identity problems. And here another point that could be made, that people who believe in the importance of the individuality and uniqueness of the individuality, they don't want to be identified by their social roles, because that's like everyone else. But I think a very serious problem of modernity is the decline of community, and that there is a great deal of that in the United States. And people are rightly apprehensive about it. There is also a great deal of effort, great many efforts in the United States to overcome this problem of community. And you have innumerable attempts to create new communities. But it's very difficult to create new communities. And then, of course, there is the impersonality and isolation and anonymity associated with urban life. There is bureaucratization. There is the destruction of the natural environment. And I think the destruction of the natural environment is a good example of the incompatibility of human values and desires. People want to consume voraciously, you know, they want to get quickly to places, they want to have their second home or second car, and you can't do that without building roads and airports and industrializing, and it's very difficult to reconcile, you know, the joys of pristine nature and high levels of consumption. And then, of course, there are the specific social problems associated with modernity, and more specifically associated with the decline of community, because the decline of community means the decline of informal social controls. Informal social controls means simply that people care about the opinion of other people whom they know and who live around them. So you have a much higher levels of crime, delinquency, family disintegration, escapist behavior. So all these problematic phenomena are prominent in American society, and they are certainly spreading around the world. And you know, this kind of modernity, the United States is spearheading, has some responsibility for these problems. But again, it's part of this phenomenon that people pursue incompatible values. Now, this brings me to further factors and further explanations of anti-Americanism. I think this is one of the most general, the objection to modernity. But perhaps there is an even more general explanation, which is that what I call the scapegoating impulse, that this is this kind of universal and timeless propensity, namely the inclination or the preference to hold others, whether they are groups, individuals, social or political entities, to hold them responsible for a wide range of problems and grievances. I think human beings have a marked preference for not taking responsibility for those of their actions and attitudes which have unpleasant consequences. And I think this is the most general background to anti-Americanism. And of course, historically speaking, there have been many other entities which have been scapegoated, minority groups, Jews, blacks, depending on the historical circumstances or location. So that's another factor. Another very important source of anti-Americanism, I believe, especially within the United States, but not limited to the United States, is that America is a country which was built on high expectations. People went there because they wanted to have a better life. Not just better life materially, but they wanted political or religious freedoms. And this is shown in the nature of American society and social institutions and popular beliefs, and actually it's even shown in the behavior of regular Americans. In other words, alongside many negative attitudes or criticisms I myself had about America, I have always been impressed by a tremendous idealism of regular Americans, which is partly a product of these high expectations. Well, it's a peculiar thing because on the one hand, American society and Americans are also very competitive. you know, and then that is associated with capitalism and, you know, wanting material success and social success. And obviously competitiveness and good personal relationships don't go well together. But there is a high degree of idealism, I think, in America, among regular people, ordinary people, which finds expression in this amazing number of do-gooding organizations, charitable organizations, or volunteer work. You know, tens of millions of people do some kind of volunteer work, and which is, I think, much less known in Europe, these things. You know, like my wife used to go and visit old people's homes and took our dog because they like to see a little dog we had, and so this kind of thing. Or a friend of mine drives sick people to the hospital. But there are an endless number of things which Americans do along these lines. I suppose you might say these are also attempts to find a kind of a substitute community that you do something to help other people. But I think the high expectations, there were also, and there remain very high expectations among intellectuals, and in fact I believe that the most embittered critiques of American society on the part of intellectuals has a great deal to do with the disappointment that United States, that America didn't live up to these high expectations, which you find in the founding documents and the Declaration of Independence. So, you know, I think it would be very difficult to find another society in which the Constitution makes reference to the pursuit of happiness, things like that. Well, that's very American. And obviously, people are bound to be disappointed when they have very high expectations. This is as true in personal relationships as in political attitudes, social, political, cultural attitudes. And I think many of the expectations the United States generated are of the nature which are probably impossible to accomplish. And as to a kind of global force for good and ending poverty and maximizing equality. Actually, you know, Americans have also somewhat rather contradictory attitudes about equality, because it is an egalitarian society in that there is this belief that basically human beings, again, this is a curious mixture of individualism, that everybody has these tremendous individual potentials which under relatively favorable conditions can be realized. But of course, in reality, Americans also worship achievement and accomplishment. And they are not particularly disturbed by these enormous income inequalities when they think that there is something meritorious associated with it. And that meritorious billionaire, you know, may be a pop singer or a football player. So, I think that, to me, is one of the most important factors also in foreign anti-Americanism, because, again, the United States was this kind of unusual democracy without entrenched elites and traditional elites. And so the, you know, early on, the United States opposed and pushed the Western European countries to get rid of their colonies, this sort of thing. So this is a cultural, historical matter. And now as to the more recent developments, why it has increased more recently, well, I think the major factor is the disappearance of the Soviet Union as one major factor, you know, which was the other superpower. Well, now there is only one superpower. So it's more plausible to blame the United States for a lot of things. But it is also true, and this is not a matter of, you know, just this is not a matter of anti-American projection, that indeed the United States has become much more assertive militarily since the fall of the Soviet Union. Not just in Iraq, but it has become more interventionist. In Panama, for example, that was a minor military intervention. No, that is something else which is important to mention, and I won't talk much longer because we should have some discussion. and that is American mass culture. Now, I think the impact of American mass culture on anti-Americanism is somewhat complicated and contradictory. Because on the one hand, people all over the world like American popular culture. I cannot fully understand why, but they do. Now, the more cynical or negative interpretation of this is that, well, popular culture is full of sex and violence, and people find that entertaining, you know, watch sex and violence. And they have found it entertaining way back. You know, people used to attend public executions. It was a great entertainment of public torture. They still attend public executions in Islamic countries. So nothing new about that. These are among the darker aspects of human nature. And so much of sports, you know, has high degrees of violence, which are also people consider entertaining. Boxing, wrestling, football, you name it, ice hockey. But more positively, people also said about American mass culture that it also has a positive message, because it often presents some kind of a heroic individual who defies the powers to be and who fights courageously against great odds and then succeeds and exposes corruption and so forth. I mean, in fact, interestingly enough, a very large portion of American, as you probably know from your experience, that how much American mass culture is involved with corruption, corporate corruption, or other kinds of corruption, bureaucratic corruption. And there are always some heroes who try to do something about it. But I think, so you could perhaps say that ordinary people like American mass culture and learn certain things about America from mass culture. And I think this makes the United States better known all over the world, no matter how superficial or inaccurate in many ways American mass culture is. But still people learn from mass culture more about the United States than any other country. So the United States is this kind of cultural presence all over the world. And on the other hand, elite groups reject mass culture because it does undermine traditional culture and traditional values. And here perhaps special emphasis should be given to Islamic countries and Islamic cultures which find American mass culture particularly revolting and immoral and morally corrupting, also because of the presentation of women. And I think it is true that American popular culture has a certain subversive effect of traditional values. Of course, some of this subversive effect should be highly welcome, especially as regards the position of women again. Now, you could mention other more specific sources of anti-Americanism. Maybe I mentioned it already. Perhaps it is among the most obvious ones that anybody who dislikes capitalism is bound to be anti-American, because the United States is the major capitalist country in the world. And its involvement with globalization, well, this is a further way of strengthening capitalism or increasing the global influence of capitalism. And people who are, I think there is a kind of confluence between the critics of capitalism and the critics of inauthenticity in American life. I mean, the old idea of Marx that capitalism undermines and deforms human relationship because of the cash nexus, that people relate to each other through material values and concerns. And I think this is often also applied to life in America, I think quite unfairly, because actually Americans are very romantic. You could argue quite the other way around, that these high expectations of American culture also manifest themselves in personal relationships, and that's why so many marriages end in divorce, because people have very high expectations. Maybe I will conclude this discussion by a very interesting and entertaining and true quote from the well-known American social historian Daniel Burstein. And this comes from a very old book, not a very old book, I think it came out about half a century ago. He has a book called The Image, and the subtitle is A Guide to Pseudo-Events in America. And this is what he said about Americans. And I think this is again something relevant to the matter of high expectations I talked about. He said, "We expect too much of the world. We expect our two-week vacation to be romantic, exotic, cheap, and effortless. We expect a faraway atmosphere if we go to a nearby place. And we expect everything to be relaxing, sanitary, and Americanized if we go to a faraway place. We expect the contradictory and the impossible. We expect compact cars which are spacious, luxury cars which are economical. We expect to be rich and charitable, powerful and merciful, active and reflective, kind and competitive. We expect to eat and stay thin, to be constantly on the move and be ever more neighborly," unquote. Well, I think this goes to the heart of, at any rate, the high expectations of Americans, which occasionally finds expression in anti-Americanism. Now, again, I want to repeat, none of it is to suggest that anti-Americanism doesn't have sources in what the United States does, and it, particularly its foreign policy. And I forgot to mention one very important contemporary factor in the intensification of anti-Americanism, besides the rise of Islam, this kind of terroristic Islam, and that is, of course, the president's personality, you know, which has really inflamed anti-Americanism around the world, because both because of his personality and his policies. I think actually the personality has been more important. So anti-Americanism is obviously a phenomenon with many roots, and I look forward to what your questions.